Now, if the Hundred Years' War was fundamentally a controversy between England and France, it was also true, given the importance of England and France and given their geographical location, that much of Europe was drawn into this war in one way or another at one time or another, and at the very least, we may say, that trade was often and seriously disrupted as a result of the Hundred Years' War. So the Hundred Years' War, the great dynamic for England and France, accentuated in the long-run trends already present in 1300 and had certain rather decisive and durable impacts on each realm. And Iberia, let's go out to the frontier for a bit. We may take 1492 as a vantage point on developments in the late Middle Ages. In January of that year, a crusading army entered Granada, and the last Muslim stronghold fell. From one way of telling the story, we might say this was the end of the centuries-long Reconquista. In March of that year, Ferdinand and Isabella issued a decree requiring the Jews of Castile and Aragon to convert or depart. Now, conditions had often been difficult for the Jews in Spain, but this act ended centuries of rich Jewish, Muslim, Christian interaction in Spain and poisoned the environment in Iberia for what had once and long been a flourishing Jewish community. In April, Isabella commissioned Cristoforo Colombo to discover and acquire islands and mainlands in the ocean sea. In other words, to begin a process of exploration and discovery. Now we're going to come back to these voyages of exploration and discovery in a later lecture. For now, let's just say, and it certainly will not have been Ferdinand and Isabella's intention at the moment, but their action in commissioning Columbus's voyages initiated the globalization of Western civilization. That, again, is one of those things that we can see in hindsight. I don't want to attribute that to Ferdinand and Isabel. Now, Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabel or Isabella of Castile married in 1469 and, as a result, brought a unification of the two great realms of Iberia. Now, this, of course, was a realm where, as we noticed earlier, from the 13th century on, crown and nobility, abetted often by the church, abetted as well by economic expansion, had been building effective government for three centuries. What Ferdinand and Isabel had an opportunity to do was to rule over more territory more efficiently and more effectively than their predecessors had ever been able to do before. But we may say, again, that the basic trends in evidence in the 13th century were going to persist, were not deflected onto new paths in the Iberian Peninsula. We might also just begin to say that by the end of the 15th century, we could start to talk about Spain rather than an Iberia where various cultures and various political entities shared the spotlight with one another. In Italy, the basic tripartite scheme that we have observed in earlier lectures continues apace. German control in the north persisted, but grew progressively weaker. In 1494, indeed, the French invaded northern Italy, without, it must be said, lasting consequences. But this is simply to us a reminder of the fact that northern Italy was again and again and again involved with powers from beyond the Alps. Now, in other regions of Italy, if we pause for a moment on the north, the other great development there is the rise of Milan and Florence and Venice. Many other cities, to be sure. You'll recall, perhaps, in an earlier lecture, we had talked about the rise of the communes, of which there were several dozen. That's all true. There continued to be a number of communes in the north. But Milan and Florence and Venice became, in a sense, the Italian superpowers. Now, each of them was wealthy. Each of them was willing to spend wealth on culture. Going to come back to these places in the Renaissance in our next lectures. But their competitions and rivalries were also disturbing and damaging and disruptive for northern Italy. Now, the papacy's control of the center of Italy was severely compromised by the absence of the popes for much of the 14th century in Avignon. What were the popes doing in Avignon? We'll explain that in just a second. Suffice it to say that much of central Italy, where papal authority had often been contested and where it had been effective or ineffective in turns over a long period of time, was very difficult to maintain when the popes weren't even there at all. In southern Italy, the basic trend that we have observed, that is to say, outside interference, continues as it has long been.